I'm going to make it work for 26.2 miles.
If you had to double your runway tomorrow, what would need to happen?
But good news, today is better than tomorrow.
I'll drink some coffee with you before the races, and I'll definitely throw down some beers with you after.
Somebody needs to talk some judgment to you, boy.
I'm saying this in a poorly articulated way.
You're really selling it.
I'll just own up to it, and let's see where it goes. You're giving me like these like Tony Robbins vibes now.
I know. Hey guys, welcome back to the Results Junkies podcast. We're a little bit off on our timing of recording, but we are still on Silicon Valley Bank because it's big just in news in general, even if you're not a founder. And it's especially huge if you happen to be in the startup community, because if you are in the startup community, I would be willing to bet a significant sum of money that you are either affected by this or you know someone that was affected by this, just based on how many startups bank with Silicon Valley Bank. Quick show reset. If you have questions for us, you can email show@resultsjunkies.com. You can find him on social media. He is at Paul Singh on all the platforms, and I am at Pizza in Motion. And Paul, picking up from where we left off last week, where we obviously have a lot more facts now. When we recorded what became part one of this two-part episode, Silicon Valley Bank had not failed yet, but we anticipated that was likely. It did fail and has had wide ramifications. I'm curious, of the people that you know and have talked to, how much this has affected your ecosystem.
Yeah, well, first off, the timing of it. So you and I recorded at 10 o'clock Eastern last Friday, and I think the failure happened at 11:43 a.m. So we were within 40 minutes of that event happening. But and then it sounds like both of us got a little sick. So that's why our part two is delayed. You know, I think the summary of it is that at least for my portfolio, one of the benefits of investing everywhere outside of Silicon Valley is that very few of them actually bank with Silicon Valley Bank. While the overall direct impact was relatively low, I think mentally the impact was relatively high because, you know, you were watching the news like I was over the weekend, particularly Twitter. Between Friday afternoon and Sunday evening, there was a lot of uncertainty about who was going to be next.
Right.
You know, and so there was, even though there was no direct impact in terms of SVB and the portfolio, I think the mental load of this weekend was wild. Like it was to the point where, you know, Dana doesn't use Twitter, but even she was just sort of scrolling on repeat through the weekend just to see, you know, to kind of keep up with things, because, you know, nobody knew if the contagion was going to spread on Monday. So a little wordy, but I definitely feel like we were mentally tired coming into Monday morning. So how about you?
I think you bring up a good point about the contagion spreading, because I think, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week where, you know, I never anticipated a world in which you would have a negative rate on a T-bill. And that happened back in the banking crisis in 2008 when everybody thought everything was ending. And I think that that's probably where I was probably less anxious than I would have been if I hadn't lived through 2007, 2008. But to your point, I knew that I needed to keep watching and keep looking for other threads that might unravel. And so same as you, I spent a lot of time over the weekend looking at Twitter. I did something, I flew on Monday, did something I never do. I watched CNBC for the entire flight, 4.5 hours to Vegas. And I mean, a lot of the stuff on there is conjecture, not fact. But you know, they had a lot of banking presidents on, and they had ex, you know, heads of the Fed, and they had some, you know, some pretty big VCs too. So I think they all understood that there was some magnitude to what happened, that it needed to be one of the biggest topics of the day, and that nobody was really sure if this was over.
I will just say that good news is that nobody in our portfolio was at least directly impacted. Less than good news is that everybody was mentally tired coming into Monday morning. I think we were all a little nervous. You know, from my perspective, I'm thinking, hey, do we need to be ready to backstop somebody, you know, if they're going to have trouble with payroll this week? You know, it was that sort of stress, right?
Mm-hmm.
This week, I will say that even though there was no real direct impact to anybody in the portfolio, there's definitely a lot of movement happening. So unless you want to know more, I'll tell you the details. But in general, people are not comfortable leaving all their eggs in one basket anymore. So if I was to summarize the movement I'm seeing in our portfolio, it's that there's a primary checking account that's holding, let's call it 60 to 90 days of cash, you know, that they can access at any time. And then they're moving the rest of their money to, you know, one of those systemic banks, like the, you know, the systemically important banks, like the Wells Fargo's and the Goldman's and the, or whatever you call them, right? There's like a G-SIB designation. I forget what you, what it stands for, but basically everybody's dividing into at least two different banks, sometimes three, but I haven't seen anybody going crazy and doing four or five or six or anything like that. But what are you seeing on your side?
A little bit of what I'm seeing and a little bit of what I think you should be telling them. And this sort of goes back to that white paper that you told me that I should write. And to be clear, still not an expert on this, not a banker. You know, talk to those folks on your behalf for individual founders. But I think there's a 10,000-foot level comment on this I want to make, but I'll start at the 100-foot level. There's a product that a number of banks offer. And when I say a number, hundreds of banks. And the shorthand of this product is called IntraFi. And essentially, it automates the process of FDIC compliance. And they do that by spreading your money out amongst a bunch of different banks and keeping you under that $250,000 threshold per account. You know, it's messier because you're with a bunch of banks, but one bank manages it for you and you generally pay some premium for that. And what I mean by that is, right now, I think what I was hearing over the weekend, and maybe this goes up if more people decide to do it, but something like 10 to 15 basis points in interest, which in the grand scheme of things is pretty insignificant, especially because as you and I talked about last week, we don't want our portfolio companies managing this money for growth. We want them managing it for safety, first and foremost, and then we want them to go grow the company. I have no issue with a 10 to 15 basis point hit first. A founder to automate something that they never have to worry about again and keeps them under the FDIC limits. For anybody that will listen to me, I'm telling them, you know, to go find a bank that has an IntraFi product and use that. Let me stop there for a second and just get your opinion on, you know, how founders should be managing that piece of it right now. A founder came to you today, you know, are you strongly encouraging to split it up? Would it stop you from funding a company if they had all their money in one bank? Like, where's your head on this?
Look, at the time of us recording this, we're still only 6 days out from when this happened. So if you were to ask me right now, any new deals that I'm talking about funding, I've just paused for 2 weeks. Like, I haven't ghosted anybody. I've just said like, hey, let's just come back together in 2 weeks and just see where we stand. To answer your question specifically, knowing what I know 6 days into this thing, I don't think I would immediately not fund somebody for not, you know, hedging against this risk. But I think you should do something. And I think that something really just depends on your level of sophistication. So if you had to do something today, I think it is smart to at least spread it out between two banks just to get started. But longer term, I agree with you. I think that it does remain to be seen which of those banks that offers these sort of sweep accounts is going to be, you know, quote unquote, startup friendly. As much as SVB was a pain in the butt about this whole thing, the thing is they were less worse when it came to dealing with startups than a lot of other banks. Wire transfers were generally easier. All their controls were the same, but you just could do more things that startups need to do quickly without having to jump through hoops. Just for contrast, maybe this is not the same anymore, but I remember in 2014 was I still remember distinctly having to open up a new operating account for one of my companies in 2014. For whatever reason, I chose to do Bank of America at that time. It was a nightmare. You know, like they didn't understand why I was depositing a couple million dollars for a company that had only been formed, you know, like 2 days before. Like it was, you know, it was just like pulling teeth, you know, and granted, my fault. Maybe I was using a local branch here in Ashburn and they just didn't get it, right? But it was a half a day thing when it should have been a 30-minute thing. Maybe that's better now. I don't know. But I guess what I'm just trying to say poorly is that I do agree with you. I think that, you know, you're generally right. It's worth paying this 10 to 15 basis points if you can get that sort of sweep coverage. I think what would be really interesting is if you or somebody you know could actually just point people at what the top 2, 3, or 4 places they should go should be. Because it is a little overwhelming to realize that 100 of these firms offer it. Mm-hmm. Startup CEOs have to already manage quite a bit, and figuring out how to pick which of those 100 is like way, way harder. So
yeah, I would agree. And I'd actually take it a step further. We don't lead a lot of rounds. And as you said, we're only 6 days in. But sort of like I learned the lesson with a portfolio company that had taken the trust funds, the money that's withheld from employees' checks for Social Security and Medicare, and used that for inventory. And we put some guardrails in place for that. I think the thing I would do here, if we led a round going forward, is I would just put a term in the document, and I would say that it is a covenant of their raise that they use the IntraFi product with a bank. I don't know, maybe we'd specify a bank rating level just to, you know, to have some level of comfort there. But I think we would require this going forward if we were leading around, just because it's so easy from what I've seen. In talking, as I mentioned, you know, my business partner is the chairman of a bank in Nevada. And we've done, when he and I spoke last night, they'd done a half a dozen of these this past week for customers. So it's not hard to do. And we're a small bank. So when we're knocking on other banks' doors, I mean, you know, most of the banks don't know us yet. We've lived around for 3 years, small regional bank, all that stuff. The bigger banks have, you know, deeper connections to this stuff. So it should be easy for them. So I think we would probably require it as a deal term. We were the lead in the round. I don't know that I would stomp for it if I wasn't the lead, because to your, you know, the thing that you and I've talked about a bunch about us wanting to be 90-10 investors, you know, if we're not the lead, then it's not something that we can really require. Certainly recommend it. And I'm recommending it to people in our portfolio now, just because I don't want them worried about their money. You know, how many founders, we have some that were a little bit affected by this. To your point, most of ours weren't directly affected. But there were founders that had a brutal weekend and paychecks that didn't go out because, you know, people that used, you know, one of the payroll providers that was at SVB, a Ripple, that, like, you know, paychecks just didn't go out, stuff like that. I don't want my founders spending their time worrying about that sort of stuff. I want them building a company.
Yeah. I think the what you just described there in terms of potential language in the deal terms, I think that's really fascinating. It's something I hadn't thought of, but I think you should talk more openly about this, because I think that a lot of stuff's going to be in flux right now. So for example, you have a lot of existing loans and existing deals that are out there with startups that specifically say the other way, which is like, hey, if we're going to, see, I don't want to like point fingers at SVB, but it's not uncommon for SVB, in exchange for giving these startups, you know, lines of credit and stuff like that, it's not uncommon to say, in combination with that, that you are now required to bank with SVB. I mean, that's a pretty well-known thing that's happening. Mm-hmm. The flip side is what you just described, where I think it's going to be interesting to see more investors start to put this term in that says you have to ensure, we'll have to figure out the language, right? But it's either something like you have to ensure up to $1 million of FDIC, or you have to do this. You know, the wording will be really fascinating. But I agree directionally with what you're saying there, because something has to give, right? Something has to be put in there. And founders on their own, they're not in a really good position to negotiate. In other words, like when SVB says you have to bank with us if we're going to do this other thing with you, founders have very little leverage there. For better or for worse, they have very little leverage. But this is where investors can add value, is if you were to put in a term that says, hey, we're prohibiting you from doing X, Y, and Z, perhaps, unless there's like express approval otherwise from the majority of the investors. Like, now you're allowing the founder to kind of play dumb and say, hey, SVB, like, we'd love to do business with you, but we can't unless you give us this term. Does that kind of make sense?
It does. And I think it goes to this point of, you know, what the banks actually require. Because to your point, we actually, you know, we saw a lot of this where SVB required a founder to put all of their money with them to issue a venture debt line against that capital. And this gets back to what the purpose of the bank is going to be. Because, and again, I'm not a banker, but SVB could still have required that and used an IntraFi product or a similar product to that to protect the founders. Now, it may come with some other risk that I'm not aware of. And I don't mean risk in terms of risk of losing the money. But if SVB's purpose, and we won't know this, but if SVB's purpose in keeping the assets under their control was to de-risk the loan, well, then the IntraFi product is perfectly fine for them because the money is all protected by FDIC. It doesn't change at all. If they're saying, hey, if you want a $10 million line of credit, you need to keep your $10 million in money that you raised in our bank, then they should be completely agnostic to whether you want to use a product that diversifies the risk like IntraFi because they still control the funds. However, in banking rules, and we won't get too nerdy because we're not a bank podcast, but typically any deposits that a bank holds, they can lever up 10x on those deposits. So if you give a bank $1 million, they can invest or loan $10 million. And so in this case, SVB levered that up to buy these T-bills. And when I say these T-bills, the T-bills that got them in trouble, they bought long duration T-bills. They bought 10-year T-bills at the wrong rate. They just got upside down in this inverted yield curve that happened. But at any rate, if they're doing that to because they want the deposits and lever up, I'm not 100% sure how the FDIC looks at that in terms of levering up and ratios and all that stuff. So I won't speak to that specifically. So I definitely think there could be some conflicts of interest to your point of maybe the bank wants the money and wants to hold it in a way that isn't conducive to, you know, some of these products. So definitely some questions there. But I also think that these are the right discussions to be having because up until now, I think, unfortunately, founders have just assumed their money is safe. And, you know, this sort of goes to this soapbox moment that I alluded to in the pre-show that I wanted to sort of talk through and not necessarily our main cup of tea, if you will. But I'm curious, you know, based on what we've known so far, 6 days, the whole bit, do you think that these founders should have been made whole on Monday morning? Like bank closes Friday, they've got $10 million in deposits, you know, 9 million of them are not insured by the FDIC. Do you think that money should be available to them on Monday morning? You think the government should make that happen?
Ooh, man, we have not talked about this, so we'll see how this goes. Okay, so if you put me on the spot and want me to, you know, shoot from the hip, I guess what I would say is that, like, I myself, when I have deposited money into a bank, I openly admit that I am guilty of not having diligenced the bank because I never thought, as a depositor, I had to do that. And so, to answer your question directly, I think, generally speaking, the answer is yes, because, again, like as a general depositor in a bank, I had never once considered that I'd have to actually look at the financials of the bank before I actually did anything. Now, I admit that that's going to maybe get me in some trouble here. I'll just own up to it and let's see where it goes. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, well, a little bit of background. I think just for perspective, there were something like in the past 5 years, I think there were 10 banks that failed in the US was the number that I pulled. Neither you nor I know the names of any of them except for the two that failed this weekend. Mm-hmm. So the other 8, I'd never heard of them. I'm sure you haven't heard of them either. And so, I mean, in those cases, there were investors who lost investors. There were depositors who lost money because they had balances over $250,000. And in some cases, the FDIC did not make everyone whole. I'm really torn with this. And I would say, I think this just goes back to your point about having a good discussion about it. And I'm going to call out a couple of things specifically. Like there were some folks out there who were very well-respected VCs who were pounding the table saying, this has to happen. And if it doesn't, you know, there are going to be problems and this is going to ruin innovation. And these people have to be able to expect that their money is going to be protected. I really wish they hadn't pounded the table and screamed and said that this is something that has to happen, because I think that's the wrong way to look at this. You know, I think what you've said is the absolute pragmatic way, which is, holy cow, I never really realized this could happen. And going forward, I have to do things differently. What I'm hearing people say is, oh, come on, how could they have ever thought the bank would fail? And I think that that's a really dangerous precedent for us to wrap our arms around. Because then it becomes, well, okay, so should they, if SVB started again tomorrow and did the exact same thing, should we bail them out again? Like if the guys who started out Silicon Valley Bank started Silicon Mountain Bank, should we, and did the exact same thing, levered up and got overextended, should we bail out those customers too? Like, I just think it's a really slippery slope. And so I was really disappointed to hear folks who I have respect for, like the Brad Gerstners of the world, and like the David Sachses of the world saying like this has got to be fixed by Monday and, you know, everybody has to be made whole and all that stuff. because to some degree, I agree that this came out of nowhere, and I agree that the banking system has changed, and social media can definitely cause a significant impact here that it never used to be able to. But runs on the bank have been a thing since the 20s. And I mean, we had years where there were hundreds of bank failures back then. So bank failures can and do happen. And if we can't learn from that history, then we're doomed to repeat it. There were hundreds of bank failures after the 2008 crisis. Hundreds.
I'm tracking with you. But let me just kind of maybe poke the bear here a little bit and see where you go with it. So generally, I don't disagree with you, but I think that I think there's two things that make this particular situation unique. I think the first is that like the makeup of SVB depositors wasn't like most other banks. So I think I saw a stat somewhere that most other banks are more like 50-50. We're like, 50% of the depositors might be individuals and 50% of those depositors might be businesses. And more importantly, that, something like 97% of SVB's assets were way above the something like 90 or 97% of SVB's depositors were way over the limit. So that's very different than most banks. So with that in mind, the first thing I would say that's a little different here is that these businesses, I'm not a lawyer, but I think you would agree with me that in most states in this country, missing payroll is the kind of offense that pierces the corporate veil. So if you know that you are at risk of not hitting that payroll, you basically have a duty to go ahead and let everybody go instantly. Otherwise, you're at risk of personal liability. I know, for example, with California companies, that is definitely true. Virginia, definitely true. I'm betting that's true for most other states. So that's part one. Piece number one that I think makes this a little different is that if I don't have any certainty on Monday morning, because we all found out about this Friday at noon, and come Monday morning, if I don't have any certainty, I kind of have a duty to play the worst case scenario as a CEO or board member or whatever, because I'm not about to risk my family's assets, my wife's, sanity about that. So that's part one that makes this interesting and unique. And I think part two is that I've heard some people like kind of try to draw parallels back to 2008, hey, these home buyers, they definitely knew what they were getting into. They should have read the paperwork, They're pointing the finger right at the home buyer as opposed to maybe the bigger systemic issue. Here, when I sign up for a bank account anywhere, Navy Federal Credit Union, Wells Fargo, SVB, whatever, there is no federally required set of disclosures that bank has to give me to certify their standing. So in other words, this is one of those rare situations where like, if I want to go buy $1 million home, you've bought homes. I mean, when I go buy a home, the government says, here's all the documents that have to be there. Now, if I don't read them, you could argue it's on me as the buyer. I get. But there is no equal set of guidelines when you open a new bank account. You and I could just run over to TD Bank right now and deposit $100 on a personal account. It'd probably take us 20 minutes to do it. And the bank has no obligation to tell us what their actual standing is. And by not telling us, it's also like, does that make sense? Like, this is a little different though, because there's no set of disclosures that's standard.
It does, but also when you deposit that $100, it's 100% insured by the government because you're under the FDIC limit. So there is less disclosure. I would say, let me lay something out and see if it changes your perspective. And for folks who are listening, we did not talk about this at all in pre-show. And then I want to talk about one other interesting element that we also didn't talk about in pre-show, just in terms of what I think SVB's deposits might tell us. They affirm something that you and I talked about in the show about a month ago. So typically the way this would be handled is bank would close Friday night. They would wait till the market closes, and then the plan would be to sell the bank over the weekend and reopen it Monday morning. That's what typically would happen. This was an exigent circumstance. They closed the bank early because they just felt like it wasn't going to make it through the day on Friday. What would typically happen is like the bank isn't broke. Like there isn't $0 left. There's many dollars left, but there's not enough dollars to pay everyone every penny they have. And so what typically happens is by Monday morning, there's a buyer in place. And in many of these situations, what ends up happening is the depositors are offered what's called an advanced dividend. So Mr. Singh, you had $1 million with us on account. You know, we've poked around the books this weekend. You know, obviously they know what the 10-year T-bills are worth because they sold them to them. So they, you know, they rough assessment of worth of what's there. Maybe it takes some time to unwind all of that, but they can look at that quickly and go, you know what, we're going to be able to recover most of the money here. The bank's going to be wiped out. Shareholders aren't going to be worth anything, all that stuff, but the depositor is going to be mostly made whole. So Mr. Singh, you had $1 million with us. We are giving you a 70% advance dividend. So in your account, in your new account right now at Nuco Bank is $700,000, and we're giving you a certificate for the remaining $300,000. And as we recover more funds, we will continue to exchange pieces of that certificate for a dividend that we'll put into your account. But right now, so you can conduct your business, here's $700,000 of the $1 million that you have on deposit with us. And they would go across all depositors and give them the same percentage of their money. And in this case, it likely would have been a number that would have been 70% or higher. And some of the folks that prognosticate on this, old Fed chairs and stuff like that, FDIC chairs, had said they thought the number could be 80 or 90%. So in that lens, if the answer was, hey, we're going to give you a 70 to 90% of your money immediately on Monday morning, and you'll have to figure the rest of it out, I'm curious if you still think that that wouldn't have been enough and that they really needed to make sure everybody was okay immediately.
I think I'm tracking with you. I would say that that would probably have worked. The thing that's missing from that, you know, two things. Number one, that doesn't help the people that are right on the edge. So like, let's just say it's a portfolio company with one payroll left, for better or for worse, that doesn't help them because there's, you know, even if you give them 70% of whatever they've got left, if that's not enough to cover payroll, that's a problem. That's part one. Then the other part is that like, you probably have to include something in there that eases the concern about the personal risk that's associated with missing payroll. Now, look, I'm not a policy guy, you know, I respect that. That's a very nuanced thing. I guess the thing I'm trying to say is that I think it was safe to assume that like this was going to get figured out. I mean, like it didn't take rocket science to figure out very quickly that fundamentally SVB could make everybody whole. The problem was fundamentally that it moved so quickly that the liquid assets of the bank couldn't keep up with the rate at which the money was coming out, right? So like, in other words,
right.
This was just a matter of time before everybody was going to get made whole. It's just a matter of time. The problem, though, was really that personal liability. The people that I talk to in our portfolio, which obviously is not everybody, but you know, it's a subset, very few of them were actually worried about not getting their money back. Most of them are really just worried about, hey, payroll hits on Thursday, which means that I was expecting the ACH debit to occur on Monday. And if that's not going to happen, then I got to do something because my personal risk is too high on this. That's basically what the risk, what the concern was. So back to your idea though, could that have worked? You know, if they had said like on Sunday night, you'll get 70% and all that stuff. Sure. It probably would have. I just don't think everybody was really worried about losing all their money by the end of the weekend. I think they were really just worried about the timing of when they'd have access to it, because that would determine the next step, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think my big fear is, and I understand that they were probably, you know, trying to balance this, you know, is there going to be contagion? And so I mean, maybe they need a strong statement to reduce future contagion concerns. The problem is that you know, you set a precedent that says everybody in SVB gets made whole 100% on Monday morning. How do you not do that for the next bank? And I'd say there's really nothing here that, at least from what I've seen so far, that would force a founder to be any more careful with their cash tomorrow than they were yesterday. And I think that's the concern I have here, is that I really feel like these founders can now go drop $10 million into another bank. And if it's not a big four bank like Wells or Chase or somebody like that, they could be picking another risky bank and not do anything to protect themselves and just expect the government's going to fix it again for them. And I have a real problem with that, because I think there are easy steps for the founders to take to protect themselves. I do want to dig into one more thing. I know we've gone long, but I do want to dig into one more thing. And we'll never be 100% sure on this, but I feel like I'm very directionally confident in this. You and I have talked about how there's less money being, you know, put out on the street right now. You know, there's less rounds closing, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think what was interesting to me, though, was if you look at the numbers, I think you can pretty reasonably infer from looking at Silicon Valley Bank that not only were they not getting new rounds funded into SVB. So VC funds, you know, Paul Singh's NewCo, Paul Singh puts that money into SVB. But what was also happening was the outflows from Silicon Valley Bank before the run of the bank last week were still high. And I think this really strongly points to the fact that since it's a very founder-heavy bank, a very startup-heavy bank, if money was still going out the door at a pretty rapid clip, that tells me that there's a lot of founders that have not reduced their burn. And that's something that you and I have talked about, where I've seen stuff getting funded, and I think you had seen some stuff as well, where it's like, I'm not sure that this is any better than the stuff I looked at 2 or 3 years ago, and it's still getting funded. And I've seen companies who, we had a founder who had a lead investor who told them that they wanted them to spend much more than their plan was. And I thought that that was a bad idea based on available capital. At large, looking at the SVB numbers, I think we have some decent empirical evidence that there are a lot of founders that never slowed down their spending over the past couple of years. Regardless of whether you agree or disagree with that, I think that's one of the lessons that we can learn from what we're seeing at SVB. And if that is the case, that scares the crap out of me.
I personally have not looked at that data, but let me just take what you said at face value and then make a comment on it. So just listening to the way you talked about that and taking it at face value, I would say that that's probably not surprising though. Because no. If you think about it, you know, going back to that portfolio company that we talked about where they got money and then that lead investor is telling him to spend the money, right? That's actually, even though I don't agree with it, that's actually pretty common behavior when you're talking about larger sources of capital that are putting money to work. Like, they can't afford for a founder to just sit on it. That's the fundamental tension, I would say, between, you know, founders and large venture firms, that there is this fundamental tension between them. Because all things being equal, a founder wants to take as much money as they can and then ideally spread it out over the longest time period that's possible so that they've got the time to figure things out. Counterintuitively, those larger sources of capital need you to burn the money faster because they're more aggressively hunting for growth. So again, taking your data at face value without having seen it, that's not surprising to me, because the most of the larger capital for these companies is still coming from Silicon Valley and or SVB intertwined banks. I'm sorry, venture capitalists. And so there is this like, you know, like they're all going to bank there anyway. Like here's the other way to say this. Many of the biggest venture firms that I know, which again, I will admit, I don't know everybody, but having been around this stuff for 15 years now, like I think I know a fair share of them. One of the most valuable products that SVB offered to venture capitalists that I don't think any other bank really offers is lines of credit that help speed up the capital call structure.
Sure.
If I'm a $1 billion fund and I know I'm going to call 10% of my capital in the next quarter, it might take up to 30 days for those LPs to wire that money in. But SVB often was willing to just front load that money right to me as a VC and then go chase the LPs down. That product doesn't really exist. Like, Bank of America is not going to give you that.
No.
and so I'm saying this in a poorly articulated way, but I guess what I'm just saying is what you're describing, even though I also don't agree with that, you know, people shouldn't be spending like it's, you know, 2019 anymore. It's also not surprising because like these big venture firms were probably banked with SVB, you know, and so like they were larger funds, they need higher yields. They don't really want a founder to sit on it. So yeah, it wouldn't be surprising to me that the founder, there might be some interesting research on this later on, but I imagine it's not surprising that a founder that banks at SVB is maybe likely to spend more aggressively than their peers. I'll probably get in trouble for stereotyping like that, but it's not surprising though. I don't know. I think that like now I think everybody should really be thinking about margins more than growth. You know, at least for the next couple of years, you should be thinking about margins more than growth. And you should take everything investors say with a grain of salt. Like, you know, it's not about growth at all costs anymore. It's about growth with margins that matters. You know, now's the time to really act more like the cockroach, you know, and just sort of optimize for being around for as long as possible. And investors aren't going to like that. That's unfortunately true.
Yeah, I mean, put another way, I would say if the current conditions haven't convinced you to spend less money, I don't know what else will. If you weren't affected by SVB, you probably know someone in the startup ecosystem that was. So if you're a founder that hasn't really given serious thought about your burn, let today be the day that you do it, because the market has changed and this is going to cause another knock-on effect. I think you brought up a really great point about it's going to be harder for founders to get venture debt going forward. To your point about fronting money, you know, for a round while a VC, you know, processes things, SVB fronting money, that's going to be harder. So now is past the time that you should be doing this, but good news, today is better than tomorrow. If there was ever a reason to start trimming back your spend, let this be another reason.
You're giving me like these like Tony Robbins vibes now. So I'm just waiting for you to send me an invitation to some airport hotel, you know, $600 a plate kind of deal.
So let's be clear. If we ever do have a Tony Robbins moment, I'm never going to do it in an airport hotel. I'm way too much of a baller for that. You know that. We're going to be somewhere much, much nicer than that.
Oh, well, that's true. I think like maybe the blunt way to put it is that if you're a founder right now, you should be doing this sort of thought exercise where, you know, the question you're asking yourself is if you had to double your runway tomorrow, what would need to happen? And for employees, I think the question or the exercise to run is very similar. If you got laid off or let go tomorrow, what's your plan?
Yeah.
I know it's not a fun conversation to have, but you got to figure it out now. Because the other side of this, by the way, the thing we haven't talked about and we don't have time today, but is for companies that are in a good cash position right now and companies that have solid margins right now, look, your competitors or soon to be competitors are probably struggling. And you know, if you've got the cash, you may be able to do a distressed buy when the time is right. Yeah. You know, and that's nobody really, I don't think anybody wants to talk about that on Twitter right now because it's considered to be cruel or whatever. I don't know, but that's the other side of what's coming now is that everybody's going to be struggling for cash. If you can get ahead of that right now, you're in a position to not only ride it out, but also to capitalize on the competitor that wasn't prepared. You know, multiples are going down, purchase prices are going down. It's just the name of the game now. Interesting times.
Yeah, they are. All right. Well, I will be at a non-airport hotel again next week. be thinking about your Tony Robbins $600 a plate.
Yeah, that's right.
You've got an interesting weekend this weekend though, right?
Yeah. I'm driving down to Virginia Beach tomorrow. I'm running an 8K at the Shamrock Marathon weekend. I'm running an 8K on Saturday and then the marathon on Sunday. So if you're in Virginia Beach and you hear this on the weekend of the race, tweet at me and let's meet up for a cup of coffee or something. It'll be fun. I can't tell you that I'm going to smell great. I'll probably be a little sweaty, but I'll drink some coffee with you before the races, and I'll definitely throw down some beers with you after.
You're really selling it.
Hey, my wife's going to drink with me, so I didn't have to sell too hard, apparently.
You talk about baller hotels. I'll be back at a place that you and I were a number of years ago, and I'm not going to tell it now because we've gone long, but I think I should tell at some point the story of you and me at a restaurant in Vegas, and you Snapchatting the bag of $10,000 that I had at the table. I'm just going to leave that there for folks.
Oh, it's going to be a good story because that's not even the fun part of the story. The fun part of the story is the four burly dudes in suits that came over and addressed you as sir and then dropped the money bag in front of you. And I'm just trying to eat my sushi. I'm like, what in the world?
Yep.
And I don't think I was Snapchatting. I think I was taking pictures so that Dana knew why I stopped responding.
You Snapchatted because I screamed at you. Yes, I remember. I think it was something along the lines of, what the F are you doing? Don't worry, Jeremiah. I won't make you beep it out.
Oh, it's so good. That's so good. Yeah. Well, I think we could tell some good stories there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, good luck with the marathon. You're crazy and maybe just a little bit certifiable, but I'll be rooting for you.
Thanks, man. What about you? Are you doing anything this weekend? Or
I'm going to take it as easy as possible because I am back on the road back to back 3 weeks in a row, and I'm too old for that.
I love it. Well, enjoy that time. Thanks for chatting today. It's always fun, and I will chat with you in a couple days.
All right, man.
All right, buddy. See ya.